We spoke to Cam a few months ago about drug addiction. We talked about your personal story, and we talked about more general stuff as well. And there were a few things that kind of came up afterwards from for people that were chatting to you. And we thought we'd come back and kind of talk about those things as well.
Yep.
But the first thing I want to mention was kind of interesting. I don't know how many people actually remember the specifics of our chat last time, but you talked about your experience of trying heroin for the first time and it didn't work, and then a guy showed you how to do it properly.
Yep.
And that guy heard, I must have heard the podcast, I think.
He did, yep.
Yeah, and he actually got in touch.
Yeah, he did.
What did he say?
So that was pretty freaky. I shared the podcast with all my friends on Facebook, all the ones I thought would be interested. And this guy that I talked about in my first interview that showed me how to inject heroin for the first time, he actually contacted me. And because in the interview I stated that when he gave me that shot, it changed my life and I was pretty much addicted and
From the get-go.
Yeah,
right.
And I went straight home and became an addict for 15 years after that shot. And he contacted me and he was heartbroken. He said to me that if he was the guy that I was talking about in the interview, that he was truly sorry and he really regretted it and he was devastated that it had affected my life on how it had. And which was quite a... I hadn't spoken to this guy since probably... within a year or two of the actual
the event
when I was 15.
Yeah.
And I had no idea that what I said would affect him like that, obviously. And he was, yeah, like I said, he's clean now. He's changed his life. He didn't get into it for too long to the heroin and stuff. He was lucky. He fell out of the scene. And yeah. He was devastated in that. And I just had to say to him, look, bro, it's... You can't blame... I don't blame him for it, you know.
You can't lay it all at his door, eh?
You can't lay it all at his door. Yeah. And I took that journey. I wanted to do what I did.
Yeah.
What he done actually was, in my opinion, I just let him know that he actually let me do it, show me do it the right way. It was the clean way. It was the proper way to do it safely. And if he hadn't have shown me that, I could have gone down the track of a lot of guys who do it and they end up getting sick. They end up obviously passing away and getting in the wrong crowds that don't actually know what they're doing, and which can be really dangerous and in the wrong circles.
So what's happening to people like that? You say they're getting sick, like they get from dirty needles and stuff. And that
dirty
sort of
needles, just injecting into the wrong veins, into arteries instead of veins. And not being clean. And then not just shearing needles, because shearing needles is sort of a thing that no one really does and really has done. It's sort of a movie thing that was done in a long time ago.
Yeah, okay.
Where they invented the needle exchange in 1987. That all changed, especially in New Zealand. It's free or very cheap to get a clean needle every time.
Right.
But he, the main thing with it was like cooking the doing the process as well, just showing me that how to do it, because if you do it wrong, it's a chemical. The chemicals you're putting into your system, and it's a chemical reaction, it's a scientific process, a formula. If you do it wrong, you're not actually making the drug you think you're making. One little step, a few degrees wrong in the temperature or something like that, can turn it into something completely different, and then you'll put a poison into you. So by doing it properly, once you've got it sussed, then it's as safe as it can be.
Yeah.
And although it's not safe, obviously, but doctors inject medicines into you safely, so you want to do it the right way. You know, the process is key. And I reassured him that it wasn't his fault and that, and he it was cool. I've stayed in touch with him since then.
Yeah.
And I've sort of explained my journey and that kind of thing, and he's become a friend again, which is cool.
Okay. That's interesting actually to have that kind of up and down and up and down.
Yeah, for sure.
Was there any negative feedback at all from people about doing that?
Yeah, quite a bit. And I was just listening, just before I came on here, I listened to a guy called The Spanian. He's an Australian, Spanish guy. He's an old gangster, a heroin addict at the age of 8. And he's changed his life, and he does podcasts and talks, and he's got his own show. And he talks a lot about that, about the hypocrites. Other people calling you a hypocrite, me a hypocrite, or something like that, because I'm not... I'm not like a holier than I'm not the totally clean, totally amazing person that they think I'm portraying to be.
You're not a pure individual. They're saying you're portraying yourself as a pure individual now.
Yeah, and people perceive that just because you're giving, not giving, telling people what to do, but just sharing your journey and trying to share what you've learned and works for you, and you know it works for you. Like I've been in the, I started at 14, 15, and on the heroin. Before that, I was into alcohol and continued on, obviously. But I was looking for ways to escape. When I was 8 years old, I was smoking dope. I started drinking heavily at 11. And I've learned a lot. I'm 50 now, and I've learned a lot. You know, I've learned a lot of things that have worked for me. And all I'm doing is trying to make it a bit easier for people to not have to go through the struggles I went through to learn those things that work, but just to help and share with people to say, hey, you're not alone. There is things that work, and these work for me, and they may work for you. That's all I'm saying. I'm just sharing my journey to try and...
Yeah.
And if everyone does that, if everyone shares their journey and the things that work for them, then the next generation or the next people that are lower down, or not lower down, but earlier on in their journey than you, can learn from that. And there'll always be people above you and below you. But if you can help people below you to get to where you are, then you'll be further on, they'll be further on, and if we can continue that process on, we can all help each other, and that's all I'm doing.
And maybe we should recap too, like you were, was it in your late 20s that you decided you'd had enough?
Yeah.
And you'd kind of, would you describe it as hitting rock bottom at that point?
I hit rock bottom when I was 28, but I started realizing when I was about 25, 26 that it wasn't for me anymore. I didn't want to do it anymore. I wasn't enjoying it. And it's the trouble with the opiates. Even when you want to give up, and you're solid and you really want to give up, you have to go through that withdrawal and pain of the withdrawals.
Yeah.
And that is, it's an insurmountable pain that is unbearable. And so you've got to get through that, which is a real hard thing to do. And that's the main sort of thing you've got to get over. And there's no really help. There's no treatment really for it in New Zealand. They can get you through it. Once you've got off the drug, there's plenty of treatments over the withdrawals. But getting through that withdrawal thing is a real big thing. And from 25, I wanted to give up, but even going on the methadone program, which doesn't get rid of the addiction, it just makes it more manageable, it was a 2-year waiting list. And so I actually hated what I was doing to myself for the last 3 years, or four years of my journey. And then when I got to 28, I had hit rock bottom. I couldn't do it. I couldn't physically find veins to have an injection. I'd run out, and fucking that was devastating for me, and I knew I had to make a change. There was no way about it. I had to do it, and the finding the veins thing, losing all my veins has affected me right until now. I went for an operation not long ago, and I had three people around me, a surgeon and two anaesthetists with ultrasounds, trying to find veins all over my body to put me to sleep for this operation.
Because you don't have like main veins?
No, so no surface veins.
Like kind of like I do, basically.
That's right. Yeah, so your main veins that you see when you pump and do weights or you do exercise, and the ones they take blood from at a medical centre, I haven't got those. But some are visible. They are there, but they don't give blood. They don't accept blood. They're filled with stale blood. So if you try to draw or inject anything into it, it will just blow the vein, and you'll end up under the skin into muscular injection.
Which is not what you're supposed to be doing.
And so they tried for 3 hours to try and get a vein, and before that, they tried for 8 days every day to try and find veins, and in the end, they had to gas me for the operation without the general anaesthetic. So they gassed me to put me to sleep and just filled me full of local anaesthetic, but when they woke me up from the gas, the local anaesthetic hadn't worked because of the infections, and so I was in agony. And they just laid me up with OxyContins until I passed out.
We know about OxyContin as well, don't we?
That's right.
That's
not good for
that's
me.
That's not a good... There's some massive lawsuits in the US against the drug companies for letting that one out into the public.
OxyContin is actually it's a morphine... it's an opiate, and it's really the new morphine... So they always change the names of drugs and sort of synthesize them a little bit over the years.
But it's the same stuff you were
same
doing.
Same stuff, yeah. It's all open.
So did that freak you out a bit?
No, because like for me, I'm so over it that I know that even if I got high, I don't want to do that lifestyle anymore. I'm not tempted at all, and that's the good thing about, and it's the hope that I'm trying to provide for people too, that if you abstain from something for more than 2 years, that craving and want for things does dissipate. It does go away. It's something in our brains that lets go of that addictive want for things. I'm not saying that it won't come back ever, but no, it's much, much easier.
We were talking off the air earlier this morning about like relapsing. Seems to be a significant event that everyone's going to, almost that, everyone's going to go through.
That's right. It's a real big thing that people think that they give up something. They say, oh, I give up drinking, give up smoking, whatever. And then they have a bad day and they get back into it. And they might, for a weekend or something, get pissed or, you know, have a little binge and they think they've failed and they give up. Yeah. And they just keep carrying on drinking. Yeah. And they think, oh, you know, I don't want to tell anyone about it. I'll closet drink now, you know, because everyone thinks I'm sober and you've told everyone that you're not on drugs anymore and you might have been clean for months and everyone's real proud of you and saying they're proud of you and you feel like a failure. So you just hide and mask that hurt with more addictive traits, you know. More,
yeah, well, and that's a cycle, isn't it? That's a cycle, shame and all that.
That's right. So you just got to be aware, and I want to stress this to everyone, If you've given up something, you've told everyone you've given up, you're going to feel like an idiot. When you relapse, and you will relapse, 99% chance you will relapse. And when you relapse, don't feel like a failure. Don't hide or anything. Just know that that's part of the journey and get back on track and be sober again for a while. And so if you're clean for 6 months, you relapse for whatever amount of time, once you get clean again, that length of time when you're clean, the next relapse will be further along in that journey.
So that's the aim.
Yep. And then the next time you relapse, it'll be further apart again. So it might be 6 months and you'll relapse, and then it'll be 12 months and then you'll relapse, and then 2 years, and then just as an example, and the journey, those gaps of sobriety will get longer and the relapses will become less and less and less, and that is part of the journey. There's no getting around that.
You were on methadone though, so does that kind of sidestep all that?
Well, the methadone is still the addiction, but it doesn't get you high in the end. So you don't have the withdrawals. All methadone does is take away the withdrawal part of the opiates.
Yeah.
Although they use it for alcohol as well, it makes you feel okay and not really bad, and so you have less chance of using other drugs. And they usually, when they're giving you methadone, they give you an agonist as well, which will, if you do take the drug of your choice, it will make you sick.
Okay,
so that's a real, it's an off-putting thing,
I bet.
Of course. Yeah. But the methadone doesn't get rid of the addiction, doesn't get rid of anything. All they're doing is giving you a managed amount of the drug that you were addicted to, and it's to get your life back on track so you can get a job and that kind of thing and don't have to mix with criminal society to get your drugs.
Yeah.
And then once that's in place, then you can look at getting off the methadone. But the methadone's just as harder to get off.
Yeah, and people should listen to our previous podcast. I'll link to it. That part of the story is a huge part of it for you.
Yep.
But did you relapse while you were on the meth?
No, because
methadone,
as I say, you're not clean.
Yeah, so right.
There's no relapse because you're still addicted, fully addicted to the drug, which is the problem with methadone. They give you methadone saying, oh, yeah, great, you're off the drug, but you're not off the drug at all. They've given you exactly the same drug as what you're taking, but it's stronger and more addictive. So that's the big problem with methadone. It does work as a tool to get your life back on track, but it's not going to cure any addiction. It's not promoted to do that.
I guess the big difference is just that it's legal and you don't have to go
legal,
get in it from gangs.
Gets you out of that criminal cycle.
Criminal.
You still have to get off it. And like you just said about the last interview, just so I can just briefly tell these people, I went to a detox to get off the methadone, which was €25,000 to do in Russia. And they did it all over the world. They don't do it anymore. But it's a big process, massive toll on my body and stuff. But that was the only way I could actually get off the methadone.
Is that basically they make you unconscious and crash your body through it?
That's right. So they force you through the addiction very fast with drugs while you're asleep, unconscious, and then you come out of that process and you're not physically addictive anymore. But you've got to get rid of the psychological addiction first and get out of that criminal world first. And the chance of relapse, once you've changed all your life and that, is pretty much nil and that's the secret to what I was promoting in the sort of saying about the first interview, is if that treatment was available around the world and be standard, then relapsing and stuff like that, doing it on your own and struggling through it on your own and relapsing and trying again wouldn't be an issue. to get your life on track, give you something that's manageable. In England, they do a thing where they give you heroin, which is much more logical than giving you a drug stronger and more addictive. They give you the drug you're already on, right, manage you with it every day so you don't have to go, and they give it to you for free. And then you go to a place and they inject it. You inject it how you want to do it. And then while that's happening, you get your life back on track, and then they withdraw you from the heroin. And that's really what that is logically. And to people, even doctors, and that usually doctors, not rehab people, doctors will say that is the best way to do it, because you're already on the drug. Stay on the drug, get your life back on track. Don't mix with the criminal world. Don't have to, Oscar, have to come up with $300 a day.
I know that if they went to change that in New Zealand, probably some politician would jump up and say, oh, they're giving druggies heroin. So let's go down that track. I had someone like, you went to Europe.
Yep.
And you did this thing where they treated the physical one, but you say you've got to treat the psychological one, and that's part of their process, is the psychological side of it. That's part of their process too, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. See, I was quite lucky and unlucky, I suppose. I had gotten rid of the psychological addiction over 15 years of being on the methadone, getting my life on track.
Yeah.
Overseas at this treatment centre, they're getting people that are straight from the addiction, straight from the street, into the thing. And so they treat addiction as a whole, and so I'm not saying I'm not addicted to things. I'm not saying that I'm clean,
What do you mean when you say you're not clean?
So I'm not a drug-free person. I'm not a fucking person that has no addiction. Like that treatment that overseas is in two parts. One's to get rid of the detox off the heroin or the methadone. The second part, which I didn't do, is to get rid of addiction as a whole. When I say that I didn't relapse and all that, I'm just talking about opiates.
Yes,
I smoke pot. I do other things. I'm no saint.
Yeah.
But I do know that treatment does exist.
Yeah.
To get rid of addiction as a whole, because I was there, and watched it happen.
Yeah.
I couldn't do it because they wouldn't let me. I didn't have family support around me, and I was too far away from home. And the trauma and healing after that, after they do fix the addiction, is quite traumatic, and you need support.
So you're digging deep.
You're digging deep, and that the treatment that they give you to cure all addiction is regression therapy. So they've learnt overseas from many, many studies, and it's catching on here, and mainstream's sort of catching on now and just following it through. But the rehabs that actually work, the real ones that have massive successes overseas, are the ones that do regression therapy. And they've learnt that addiction to anything at all, or all humans have the dragon lives within us all. Like everybody is craving that want, that filling that hole so they feel just good. The sorrow is no there. Everyone cries, everyone hurts it sometimes, and it's because they're just feeling lost. We've got this hole, and that's another realm into the family unit thing that I'll go into next interview.
We should mention it now. Yeah,
okay, sweet.
Yeah, because I've played talks by Dr. Gabor Mate and Johan Hari talking about addiction and the traumatic roots of addiction.
Yeah.
And so this is what they're trying to deal with.
That's right.
Yeah, it's no good just treating the physical addiction.
No. And the thing of addiction, that's the reason it's taken over the world in the last few centuries is because, it's thought that as a family unit in the village, when we were all ethnic races in our little villages, we lived in villages our entire life, with our families our entire lives, and we never went out of that village, and we had roles, and we knew what we were doing, and we existed as a unit, as a whole, like a unit, we all had our jobs for the common cause. And unfortunately, as time's gone on, we have dissolved that family unit. So we get to 15 or whatever, leave home, and we all go off and we move all over the world and we separate. So all the trauma and all the things we go through on a daily, day-to-day basis as kids, and as our brains are developing emotion and ways to cope with things, we were dealing with daily. So your kid skins his knee and another kid goes, oh, you girl, you cried. That hurt that person, that boy or whatever, or that girl is emotionally hurt by that. So they talk about that when they're having their feet around their fire. They talk about it. Their auntie says to them, oh, I dealt with that when I was a kid, and this is how I coped. And it's not going to affect your life. Don't worry about it. And that it's dealt with daily.
So it's a proper support
network. It's a proper support network. Yeah. And it's dealing with other people's journeys and you're getting your information from people you respect and people that know that have been through your stuff, and that's it, you cope with it, you learn to cope with it, and that's how you build your coping mechanisms. Whereas now, we don't have that support. We have one auntie with us, or maybe none, and or one uncle, and they might not have been through that, so they can't give you the advice, or the friend you don't really respect or whatever, none of that support is given to you and that advice, so we just chuck it in our backpacks, deal with it later, and then eventually that backpack becomes full, pulls us back, we fall on our shit, and then we have a solid hurt that can't be filled with anything, and that hurt we fill with addictive things that give us endorphins, and that endorphin masks the pain. And some things are fine. You can be addicted to exercise and stuff like that, and that's a healthy addiction.
There's some things, some addictions that our society totally looks heaps praise on. If you're addicted to work,
that's right. That's a good thing. Until you become so obsessed with work that you become antisocial, and that's bad. But there's all these levels that say, "Oh, this is the level you have to be at," and this is, and then if you're not at that level, you're a failure as well. So you get more, you're more hurt.
So that external validation that I'm wanting.
That's right.
Visible success in the eyes of the rest of society.
That's right. So we can't deal with it every day with the family unit, and that's what's caused this whole. So at addiction centres, what they do is we mask a lot of this pain from our childhood trauma, and a lot of us can't remember even that we had trauma, you know, because our brains are very powerful. They mask this pain, don't want to remember it.
Well, yeah.
And so they ask people, have you go through traumatic things as a child? They go, no, I had a great childhood. But really, they don't actually know. Because you've repressed stuff that you can't remember. So these centres, they give you a few drugs that take you back into your memory. Ayahuasca, Bagani, and they're all usually ethnic medicines that have tribal medicines and stuff like that.
Have been used for centuries.
From indigenous cultures. And they actually make you remember, so they talk you back through memories that you can't even remember. They bring up stuff that is in your brain that you've forgotten about or masked. And by talking about that trauma, then they can give you a little bit of advice, coping mechanisms to deal with it. And by doing that, it eases that or empties that backpack that you've got sealed on your back. And by doing that, they've realized that there's no need. The human brain doesn't want that endorphin rush, doesn't need anything filled or happiness filled, because it's dealt with its issues. And we can move on with life and carry on the new issues that are coming up instead of, you know, not being able to cope with anything because it's overwhelming. It becomes all-encompassing. And they believe that is the core for addiction. And the rehab I went to is 99.9% success rate for curing addiction. So they, once people leave their centers...
We don't hear about it. That whole thing is really interesting. Like I mentioned Dr. Gabor Mate, who's in Canada, and he's been trying to do things with ayahuasca, and the government tries to close him down periodically.
That's right.
You went to Russia.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting in the current news context, where Russia is everything evil is from Russia, but that's where you went for as a proper successful solution. Yeah,
that's right, because they're pragmatic and they're a matter of fact, and they just do. In Russia, because they're Eastern Bloc and they don't have to conform to the FDA and stuff, they do what works, and if it works, they carry on. They don't have someone coming in and saying, "Oh, you can't give them that because that's a dangerous thing." But well, hold on. That dangerous thing actually works for this person.
What they'll say is, they won't say directly that it's dangerous, they'll say that there's not enough evidence to prove that
it's
safe.
That's right. Yeah. And how do because you bloody get you the evidence done, if you can't do the fucking test?
You can't...
sorry about that, mate.
Yeah, you can't do... you have to do the gold standard, the double-blind placebo test with thousands
that's
of
right.
people.
Yeah.
And there's no money in it for something like that because no one's going to make a big
and
profit.
And it's very, very hard to do a study on a private issue like addiction because it's... And the rehab world and the addiction world, everything's anonymous and it's private and it's protected. So to do studies, to get people that are addicted to something to go on a bit of paper, even though it's nameless, they don't want to be recorded. They don't want to put in their statistics, and it's their right to do that. So to build all that up is very hard, and to get proof of things is really hard in the addiction world. And but whereas Russia and that, and Russia, South Africa, places where South Africa, not so much now, but it used to be apartheid, they did things that worked. They didn't follow any FDA things.
So South Africa's been incorporated into the Western pharmaceutical system.
Yeah. Because back in the day, that's the one I went to, he was actually in South Africa.
You were going to go to that one?
Yeah, I was going to go in Perth, but it started off in South Africa, the rapid opiate detox under general anaesthetic. and which led to his studies to find out what the addiction was, what caused addiction.
Yeah.
Because the addiction processes, the rehab processes around the world, they found weren't working. Counseling wasn't working. Counseling helps, but it doesn't cure anything. It's a coping mechanism, just like everything else. But this guy, Dr. Vorobiev, wanted to find a way to cure addiction and what caused it at its root. And him and your mate, Dr.
Gabor Mate.
Yes.
Yeah, in Canada. He's in Canada. Yeah.
Yeah. They all sort of got on the same wavelength. Well, the individual studies.
Probably independently, yeah.
Yeah, but then realised that, hey, this is actually a thing starting to take over the world now, which is really great.
Yeah. Hey, so there were other things I think you wanted to bring up. Talking about justifying, I've just got a scribbled note here.
Yep.
What was that about? What did we want to talk about there?
Justifying, I can't remember that one. What was that, my mate? Justifying.
What did we write that down?
What did you write that down, mate?
What about the hypocrisy thing? Well, we kind of talked about that, but that seems to be something is it other people who are still addicted who are saying you're a hypocrite?
Yeah, well, actually, there's a lot of people, and that's what I was getting to with the Spanian. I listened to a guy called the Spanian. He's a ex-addict in Australia, and he was talking about the feedback you get and the negative comments and stuff you get back from people, or hypocrite or whatever.
And he'll get it more if he's got a podcast that's got reasonably big.
He's really big. He's up front about his stuff. He doesn't hold back for nobody. He's a full-on gangster.
Yeah.
And I urge anyone, that especially younger people under 40, if you want to hear someone that knows their shit and talks in the way that you're used to, this is the guy you want to listen to. He's the man. And he's successful, and he's doing what he says. And so he talks about this negative comment things, and it's a 10-to-1 ratio pretty much that of comments and the way people talk to you. So he puts his podcast out. He gets, say, 10 likes to 1 dislike.
Yeah.
But in his comments below, it's all negative. So the people who don't like your stuff are the more likely to talk to you about it. So you'll get the odd person going, yeah, it was great. But the person who really drills you and says, yeah, you're a hypocrite, you're scum, you know, how dare you do this, you know, you're just doing that, you're not even cured, you know, all this negative stuff, they're the people that will talk to you and drill you. Whereas the people that really liked it, they won't talk much. They'll just say, oh, good on you, that's really great, you know, and that's all good. But the ones that will sink in is that negative thing. But you just got to remember that for every 10 people, that every person that gives you a negative comment, there's 10 people that were supported by your talk, that were supported by your information, encouraged by your information and really liked it. So the negative kickback that I get and the hypocrite stuff, I've got to learn. I've got to learn to just brush that aside, take it on, just listen to it. Yes, that's your opinion, that's cool, but I can't let that stop me.
Well, they're exhibiting their own issues anyway when it's easy to say that, but I know what you mean. It's hard. Even one comment to me will set me back.
Yeah, goes back to the childhood trauma. Like, well, someone says to you in the playground, one little comment, you might be liked by everybody in the school, but it takes one little phrase, one sentence to really hurt you and put a hole in your confidence.
We tend to learn too much. We learn to pay attention to what other people think of us.
That's right.
And we should unlearn that.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, hard to do when you're 50.
That's right, yeah. If we had the family unit to deal with it each day, it would be easy to deal with.
Yeah, so when we say family unit, you're talking about like a village.
The village of great-great-great-great-grandparents, if they're still alive, 2 babies.
Yeah,
you know,
and cousins and uncles and aunts and all that, yeah.
Yeah, learning from others' experiences.
The old way. And do you want to reiterate the no one's perfect bit?
Yeah, I really do.
Because I think that's something we were talking about off the air. We've run over time, but we'll keep going.
Yeah, cool.
Was that people are looking like people have relapsed or something, and they're just thinking they're useless, and they're looking at other people whose lives appear to be in order.
Yeah.
And thinking they can't possibly measure up, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So what are you saying about that?
So what I've learned this, and I've learned it through every. I've been through a lot of journeys, journeys along my big journey, sub journeys, if you will. And I got into spirituality for quite a few years. Did spiritual healing, cleansing. I didn't know anything about spirituality, but I was introduced to it and realized that it's a real thing. And I, because spirituality and that kind of thing, you sort of learn that everybody's on the same journey. Everybody's on the same path. We're a whole unit of life, you know?
Yeah.
And the thing with the getting it sussed, you know, people look, and not even at addicts or anyone like that, they'll look at someone else and think, oh, God, I wish I was like them, the envy. And they go, oh, man, their life is sussed. They've got it so cruisy to do this, to do that. That's what I want to do. But let me assure everybody listening, no one has got it sussed. No one has done everything they wanted to do and don't have to try anymore. And just another 50 years of their life, they just sit back in their armchair and they're happy, 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 just doing their thing. That's not life. Life, the way humans experience joy in that is the journey. It's learning and knowledge. And I've had people diss me for this, but I assure you, this is how it is, mate. It's the journey, and knowledge is love. Love is the thing, the thirst that keeps us going, keeps us happy, and it's learning ways and things and getting through hurdles of our journey towards our goals is the thing that brings continuous joy in our life. You've got to try all the time, and those little successes will bump you up and bump you up and bump you up and keep you on the high parts of your little flow along life. And once you reach a goal, that's very well. Yay, big celebration. But once you get to a goal, that becomes, oh, yeah, now what? You know, like yeah. You're not just get to your goal and then that's it, cruise for the rest of your life.
The goal is sobriety.
Yeah, that's right, yep.
Being drug-free, whatever.
Yeah.
But you get, well...
Well, you get to drug-free and your sobriety and then, oh, well, okay, I've done that. Now I've got 50 years of life to live. What's going to bring me joy now? What do I look forward to? What's going to bring me joy? So you have to make these new goals all the time. And the journey to sobriety you might not get there. You might be on that journey and relapsing every now and again for the rest of your life. But those little journeys along that along the clean parts are joyous.
Yeah,
so you've got to appreciate that joy. And looking at someone and saying they've got it sussed and all that, I assure you that and they have days where they sit and cry. And maybe not cry, but they're not happy. And that can fester and become really bad, or it can just go away. And that, but no one... There's a thing with I said this in the last interview. There's a movie called Scarface, and it's actually Al Pacino, and he wants to be an American gangster and drug lord and that, and he's in Cuba, and he's tortured and that in the prisons. Gets to America, yay! I'm going to be the biggest, the best, everything. I want the whole world and everything in it. And throughout that movie, he gets that. He gets to the top level. He gets to the top gangster. He's got all what he wants is drugs, money, woman, and parties. He gets there, and then there's a scene in the movie when he's sitting at a table and he looks at all around him and goes, yeah, I'm here, I'm the biggest man there is yet. Now what? Now what? I'm the biggest gangster there is, and everyone hates me.
Yeah,
So it's just got to remember that it's the journey that brings you the joy. The success at the end is temporary, and then ready for your new step and your new journey. So you've got to reassess all the time and just be aware. I want to say this too before we go. I spoke to a guy last night who has a bit of a issue with drinking. I didn't know this. He just came up to me randomly, which happens a lot.
People, it does happen to you, man. I've noticed that. That does happen, eh?
Yeah. And, just in the car park, and guy comes up and he says, I've got a drinking problem. And he didn't know. I don't know if he told me that because he knows I was on the radio or not, or who knows. But he just started telling me, and he was getting pretty down on himself, and instead of getting clean, he was buying more beer to get drunker, more drunk. And he was just saying, I could hear, he was feeling like a failure. And so he told people he was, getting sober, and he's on, telling publicly people he's, getting, people are giving him support, and here he was drinking his sorrows away. I just said to him that, are you happy? Are you happy with the way you're drinking affects your life? And he said, no, not at all. And he knows that. And I said, well, what are you doing about it? And he goes, well, I'm trying. I'm doing this and doing that. But here I am drinking and da da da. And I just said to him, mate, the thing, first of all, your current situation is not your final destination. Just because you're failing, just because you're struggling doesn't mean you're failing. And being aware that your problem is affecting you and your life and your people around you, that is good. That is enough for now. You know, be happy with how far you've gotten, not how far you're going to get. It's all about, if you're aware of something, then subconsciously your brain will be working. Little things will happen to build that awareness and make you achieve little steps or coping mechanisms to achieve that, what you're trying to achieve, that soberness or whatever it is. But don't beat yourself up. Don't sit there and just because you've fallen off the wagon, think, oh, my whole world's stuffed and everyone's going to hate me and I'll just drink more because I don't want to tell anyone. Tell people you've relapsed. Tell people, yep, I was trying really hard. I lasted 3 months sober. Yeah, I got drunk for the weekend, but next time I'm going to do 6 months sober, you know, or I'm going to try again. Just trying, being aware is enough. It be happy with how far you've got, not how far you're going to get. You know, so long as you're trying and you're, I mean, if you're drinking and it's and you're getting arrested every week and, you know, getting DIC and you're happy with that, shit, carry on, mate. That's all good. But if you're not,
I guess there are people happy with that.
There is heaps of people happy with that.
Okay,
mate.
All right. I'll take your word for that. Yeah. Hey, there was one thing I wanted to ask you about, and it does tie back into that thing about people you're comparing yourself to someone who looks like they've got their life in order.
Yeah.
I think the question I was going to ask you was when you were still addicted, were the people around you getting really annoyed with you and probably feeding more negativity your way?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, were they just pissed at you because you'd let them down or you'd done something that they didn't want? Or
yeah, yeah. Well, the thing is, everyone's envious. There's a thing, I don't know, well, you would know, tall poppy syndrome.
So yeah, we live in New Zealand.
We live in New Zealand, yeah, yeah. So as soon as someone succeeds and is doing better or is further on in their journey or it just other people perceive them to be moving up past or out of their level playing field, people get jealous. And they might not even know they're jealous, but they'll find a way to say something to you to try and bring you back down to their level so they can be above you again. And it's
so this is when you were trying to get out of that life. That's what was happening to you.
Yeah, for sure. I used to get people that would like come around and tempt me. Like I'm solid when I give up something, when I say something, when I do something, I'm probably too honest, I'm probably too truthful, but when I say something, I've thought about it over, and I'm an overthinker. I think about things a lot before I do and act and say things. So when I said I was going to give up drugs, I meant it, you know, the heroin.
Yeah.
I said, I'm going to give up needles, I was solid. So there was no way that I was going to put another needle in my arm. But I had people coming down from Auckland they'd never shouted me shit in their life. But they heard that and saw me getting clean, and they come down and they have free, you know, hundreds of dollars worth of heroin.
Free drugs.
And a couple of needles, and go, come on, man, you want to go on.
Are those people who were dealing?
Nah.
Oh, really?
Nah, these are mates.
You can understand a dealer wanting to do that. Yeah, like they don't want to lose a good client, right? Yeah.
Nah, this is a thing that's nothing to do with money. It's to do with their ego of me giving up, and they deep down want to give up, but they can't.
Yeah.
So they see me as someone, so they want to bring me down again, so they can say, ha, 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 you know better than me.
But, so that was a completely different but very interesting answer than what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Like I was just going to say, like, maybe there were people around you who weren't part of the scene but were in your life and were, like, just getting annoyed with you, angry with you. Or did you kind of, like, shut them all out in the end?
That's what happens when you get heavily addicted. You don't see those people.
Yeah.
I did have people in sort of three-quarter, when you're nearly at that level, people are doing that. I had family sort of, people hated me. Like I had a few different groups of friends. I had drinking friends, heroin friends, and pot smoking friends.
Okay, right.
All of them are anti the other one.
Yeah.
Even had heroin friends that didn't shoot up, and then the ones that did, and they hated each other. You know, because you do that, but you know, don't.
They're all passing judgment to avoid looking at themselves.
That's right.
And that's
the good thing about. Brings me back. I have a lot of sayings that I tell myself that I learned through that have sort of really stuck to me over the years. And the real big one at the moment is don't judge others because they sin differently to you. Because we all sin. You know, it doesn't matter. Think about it. Don't judge others because they sin differently to you. Just because he's a heroin addict and you're a pot smoker, you're no better than him. You know, you've got no right to tell him what to do. The only right you've got is to talk about your addiction, your stuff. and how you've dealt with it. You have no right, until you've lived in someone else's shoes, someone else's life, and someone else's pocket, you know, you've got no right to tell them how to act or what to do. You can only support them and tell them about your stuff, because no one knows till they know.
So let's just wrap up. I guess for people, if that old thing, if someone's listening who's ready to do something, where do they go?
Okay, so you can give me a call.
Yeah,
you know, Aaron can pass on. It can be anonymous. You can text me or whatever you want to do, or you want information. Or there's a thing I belong to called the Peer Support Group.
Yeah,
It's for addict support, and there's another one called Addicts Supporting Addicts. They're both online. They're private groups. You don't have to give your name, anything like that. You ask to join and they accept or deny you, but usually accept you. And it's only, there's no doctors, there's no anyone else except people who are on the same journey or similar journeys as you.
Yeah.
And it's just to share anything at all you want to share, except on how cheap your drugs are to buy. So there's none of that.
Yep.
But it's people who are trying and sharing a journey. So Peer Support Group, Addicts Supporting Addicts. And if you want to listen to positive reinforcement and people that have gotten further on in their journey to you, and I said that specifically, not people who have succeeded,
yep,
people who are further on the journey, yep, than you, there's a real good guy under 40. You want to listen to the Spanion, Spanion or OAN,
I think it was, yeah,
we, and yeah, or another guy who's not so gangster, and he's Trent Shelton, and he's an ex gunslinging drug addicts from America, who's goes all over the world doing massive talks. He's a multimillionaire now. Trent Shelton, he gives, and that's for anybody, not just addicts, anybody at all who's a little bit depressed or a little bit down or whatever, just to feel better. It's a positive life coach.
Yeah, well, that positive story's a good, eh?
Yeah, mate. Yeah.
Hey, folks, we've been talking to Cam about drug addiction, a second interview. Maybe we answered some questions. Maybe probably created more questions as well. For that one, so let us know. We'll put I'll get Marky to write this one up as well, so we'll put that out.
Any questions anyone's got, put them to Aaron, and we'll try and talk about them on the next talk, and we'll try to get a show together and make this a regular thing.
Yeah, that'd be a cool thing. If anyone wants to get in touch with the radio, it's our website, raglanradio.com. It's got all the contacts. It's the easiest thing, and we're on Facebook and all that kind of stuff as well. Hey man, thanks for coming, and awesome to talk to you again.